Hello everyone, it's June 11th, 2024, so Starship has launched for its fourth time. It's done better than it ever has so far. There were some exciting moments, one in particular that meant certain destruction, but that didn't happen. It's a tough little ship. It's actually not so little. Whatever, let's do the show and liftoff! And we've got the tower. Welcome to episode 463 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Dennis.
So, sad news hit us this week. William Anders, the Apollo 8 astronaut, was unfortunately killed in an airplane accident this week. I don't know how many times we've said Bill Anders' name on this show, but it's got to be about a million. And yeah, the Apollo folks are slowly taking off and doing whatever they're doing. If you're feeling nostalgic, you know, they're doing whatever the next thing is. And this one is going to be tough because he was actually the pilot of the aircraft that crashed. He was out aviating, which is probably exactly what he wanted to be doing. But you know, he survived by his family, and they're going to have to handle the inevitable investigation from NTSB. And we'll see. Hopefully it wasn't, you know, human error, but that happens. And, you know, the guy was 90 years old. Rest in peace, Bill Anders. It was good having you.
Yeah, for real. Apollo 8, when they took the Earthrise photo. He wasn't part of like my favorite conversation that ever happened on an Apollo mission where in that case it was Borman, I think, was telling Lovell, like, all right, easy there, Lovell. Calm down there. Settle down. But Anders was just kind of hanging out there. But yeah, what a shame.
Starship Test Flight 4. I watched it. I actually tuned in. I don't know why I say that.
Oh, cool.
I don't tune into anything. I clicked on Tim Dodd's live stream, let's say. About 23 seconds late, though, so I didn't see it actually lift off, but I almost did. It seemed to be going well. But the first thing I noticed was that there, you know, it was missing one engine. Not a big deal. I don't know exactly when it went out, maybe T plus 5 seconds or something like that. But even at that low an altitude, I think the booster can compensate just fine. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the threshold is, but, you know, 4 or 5 engines go out, you know, shortly after leaving the launch pad, that might be a problem. Mm-hmm. So one key difference, and actually we can talk about this a little bit more if you have anything to add, the interstage, right? The hot staging shield / vent that sits atop that booster, that was jettisoned, which is one key difference between this launch and the last one. But apparently during the last launch, and I don't remember if we discussed it, but it very likely, and I don't know if this has been confirmed, it probably did lose that interstage. And there's a great YouTube channel, I don't know if you ever watch it, called CSI Starbase, where they basically look at all the forensic evidence. You know, they kind of take that tack.
Oh, cool. What a great name.
Yeah.
Their best guess is that it actually lost the interstage part of the way down during the descent, because it has a series of clamps, and I'm guessing that a couple of them failed, or maybe at least one, and that was probably enough to rip it off.
For flight 3.
Yeah, IFT-3,
yeah,
right?
Okay. Right, which I didn't know. I did not know. I don't remember talking about that at all.
Yeah, same here. That was news to me when they started talking about how the ring was messing with things in IFT-3. Yeah.
But yeah, so this time I guess the idea was just go ahead and jettison it before you even, like, you know, like actually begin reentry. And the reason for that might be partly just because they're not sure if it will hold during the descent. Maybe those clamps aren't working as they had intended, but there's also a lot more weight. And I think that this is a difference between IFT-3 and 4. I don't know when or how many more of, you know, these stringers, which is, you know, kind of like the reinforcements that they add to that stage, but that has added some mass. And so they need to actually take away some mass. And so
it doesn't stay with Starship, right? It stays attached to the booster.
Right. Well, yeah. Okay. And that's what I'm talking about, is that they added those stringers to the booster, and they need to reduce weight just because of the added mass. Because the fuel left during descent is very low. I don't know how much, but if you watch, like if you watch the live stream and you see it coming back, and if you look at that little display at the bottom, it looks like there's no fuel. I mean, there is, but it's
a little sliver.
It's only a couple pixels worth. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a couple pixels, and so that interstage might be a little bit too much. I mean, and we don't know how much it weighs. I'd heard Scott Manley say on his video 10 tons.
Jesus, which is really?
Something like 10 tons, which wouldn't surprise me really, because when you look at, I mean, think about how large, like if you think about the diameter.
Huge forces, yeah. Yeah, big diameter, big forces, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it weighs quite a bit. But the thing is, at some point, they're going to have to keep it attached, right? Because the idea is 100% reusability, and you don't want to have to ditch that component each time that you launch. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how they're going to address that. I'm thinking maybe this time it was more just because of the risk of the interstage, you know, just coming off during the descent. Maybe not just because of the added mass, although that's probably part of it. Mm-hmm. And maybe once they, you know, get that dialed in, they can be left with a little bit more fuel. Speaking of which, and I was not aware of this, and I don't remember if this was, I guess this is how they did the last one. During return, a Falcon 9 first stage does relight the engines during the boost back, and then, you know, it turns them off, and then it relights them again during, you know, the touchdown. But on the Starship booster, that is not the case. It's just a completely ballistic return the whole way up until, you know, the final, I guess, you know, the final couple of thousand feet. So it actually picks up quite a bit more velocity and higher G loads too, I believe. I'm not sure about that, but I remember during this launch, it was like 5.1 Gs. So that's quite a bit of deceleration. Falcon 9 first stage, not sure if it's quite as much, but again, that is why I think that they had to, you know, maybe add those stringers just to keep it reinforced.
When they want to actually catch the booster, will it then have to do a burn to kind of return to
get back home? Yeah.
I hadn't considered that. Yeah. Because it's going out over the ocean and it's going to need to come back. I don't know.
It would have to, yeah. I mean, that'd be some serious lift, I suppose, to be able to just on its own be able to return.
No. I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that they're keeping larger margins, larger fuel margins for these test flights. And, you know, since there's no payload going along, we're really talking huge margins. Like all the payload, subtracting all the payload in itself is a big margin. So then you add more margin on top of that. But like, that's fine. Like it's a test flight. Go ahead and, you know, don't push anything that you don't have to. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to expect that in the future, that's going to be a thing that's done.
Yeah, that seems to be the theme, was like on this test, let's have the two stages splash down. And let's do everything we can to try to make that happen. And it worked.
Yeah. And it did just occur to me that I don't believe that the booster was fully fueled anyway. So that's probably, that kind of solves the issue there for me.
That would do it,
yeah.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So that's probably why. Yeah. So the first stage came back great. And at first there was no, during the live feed, there was no footage from any other source other than the onboard cameras. But I have since seen some. So something, I guess like a drone, I'm not sure, caught the landing. Although during, like, I think like the last couple seconds, you don't see it hit the water, which is kind of frustrating. It actually cuts back to the stage. I don't know what happened there, but the fact that there was something there to record that kind of tells me that maybe they did hit their mark, right? Because otherwise they might be too far away. But this was, you know, within like, I mean, it looked like a couple hundred feet, or maybe, you know, maybe like 1,000 or so, but it looked pretty close. Could be a buoy, which if that's the case, those don't move. So I mean, Starship touchdown exactly where it was supposed to.
They do a little bobbin. Yep, that looks like a bobbin buoy in the foreground. And poor discretion for cutting the camera back like that. I agree.
But, yeah.
But wow.
The humidity conditions were just incredible for this. Like, you've got those beautiful, like, shock cones coming off of it during launch. You've got the cloud, that low cloud layer evaporating in a circle and then strobing. And then on the way back, you get a nice shot cone at the bottom of the booster. Like, it sucks that everything was so cloudy and you could barely see anything, but like, oh boy, there's some really cool atmospheric effects happening.
Wow.
So yeah, watching the buoy cam is really tough because the frame is so wobbly as it's either rolling shutter due to the buoy moving up and down, or it's image stabilization. But it really looks like the entire booster is wobbling back and forth, doing pretty hard pitch and yaw maneuvers But I don't think that actually happened. I think it probably came down pretty straight, and it's all camera effects.
There's some serious fire happening. That's not engine fire, but like, yeah, just gases combusting or something. Yeah.
I mean, I'd heard that maybe that's a result of the one engine that went out, but I don't know, because would you see that much fire as a result of that? I mean, shouldn't that be?
I don't know. The one engine that went out was not one of the landing engines. It was on the exterior ring.
Right.
So yeah. I tend to think it's probably just methane vapors that gathered in the in the engine compartment. And, you know, it's not super unexpected. The fire does seem larger than expected, but like we would expect at least a little bit of fire. So it's going to be interesting to see if how out of family this.
Yeah, I was going to say they'll want to. I imagine they'll want to figure that out a little better,
right,
before they actually try to catch this thing. So yeah, not to get too far ahead, but so it looks like the theme is now both stages splashed down successfully, and both of them had let's just say anomalies on the on the return.
Yeah. This one seems a little bit more minor. It seems that it was just, you know, the engine out and that was it. Although we don't know what caused it, but you have like how many engines on the first stage? A lot.
33.
Yeah, I think it's 33.
Yeah. And that's kind of the blessing and the curse is like you've got a ton of engines to rely on them all working, but you also have a ton of engines that you don't really need to rely on any of them working. You know, you can have an engine out that's only 1/33 of your total thrust. Totally fine. But yeah, I think especially with an experimental engine like this, yeah, you're probably going to see engines going out a lot, at least at the beginning of Booster's or Super Heavy's career.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, so I guess moving on to Starship, right, which did continue to orbit, that all went much better. No crazy tumbling like last time. So they seem to have fixed that problem.
So what was this? Did it get up to orbital velocity or was this suborbital? Because I thought they were going for suborbital.
Yeah, well, so as I understand it, it was orbital velocity, but it put the perigee inside the Earth. So, yeah, like it was going to come back one way or the other.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, yeah, up to orbital velocity, maintained stability, looked great. Then on its reentry, about, you know, like right at about 100 kilometers, right at the Kármán line, it's, you know, starts to glow, which is to be expected. But then we see on the forward fin some plasma that seems to be like leaking through that joint there, and that wasn't good. And yeah, this was like probably the highlight of this particular launch was that it just started to melt away, and they had a camera right there in like a great spot, and you could just watch the fin start to disintegrate.
Yeah, it glows and glows and glows, and then just the skin burns through.
And I was thinking, you know, that's it, it's toast, but it just kept going. Like, I mean, it didn't come off and it kept on actuating. Like, I mean, you could see it.
That's the incredible thing.
Yeah. And so I'm guessing that, and I mean, this is just I don't remember, but I'm pretty sure, right, that there's like two hinges there, right? So you have two actuators, right? Like one at the rear and then one at the fore of that fin. And so the rear one just pretty much melted and was completely gone. But the forward one seemed to still be working because, I mean, like all the way down to splashdown pretty much, I think. I mean, you could barely see it because a lot of that material that was coming off of the fin was covering the camera. So you really, it just started.
Right.
Yeah, that was unfortunate that, like vaporized and melted metal went and coated the camera.
I had heard that maybe the rear fin had a similar problem, probably not to the same extent, but there was a little bit of air or plasma that could be seen coming through, you know, that little joint there. So I guess this is not a solved problem yet, because I remember, on the Starbase tour Tim Dodd did like a year or two ago, this was something that was mentioned. There was a real problem. Like, how do you address that? You know, like you have to shield this sensitive part of the spacecraft, but you have to have room in order for that fin to, you know, flip and move around. So I don't know, like, I guess just more shielding on the other side, maybe? You think that might do it?
It seems like that would just trap the gases inside, but maybe, you know, less airflow is a good thing. It's kind of like if you have two windows open in the house, you can get a breeze, and you only need to close one of them to stop the air moving through. And so, you know, if re-entry heated plasma flies outside, well, you can still leave one window open and just close the other. If one window's stuck, you can close the other one and you'll stop quite as many flies as getting blown into your house. So yeah, I think you might be right. Maybe you can't solve the leak on the front side, but if you can solve the leak on the back side, then all the air that's in there will push against new air being blown in.
Okay, so that's interesting. I mean, I don't know if that would, because that actually isn't what I meant, but that might work.
Oh.
I just meant shielding the fin itself so that even if, because the part that was like starting to melt, like if you imagine that that didn't melt, then maybe it wouldn't be a problem. But I mean, the hinge is really the problem, like the actual physical contact part of the hinge, which I don't know how you shield that at all. But I was talking about the rear side of the fin, the leeward side.
Make the whole fin out of reinforced carbon-carbon or something like that.
Kind of.
I mean, it seems really tough. Like if you're having to put heat shielding on leeward surfaces, it seems like you're fighting a losing battle at that point. And, you know, it seems like an architecture change would be a little better, but I mean, I'm kind of surprised, like, you know, if you watch like flaps on an airplane wing, you've got the main flap and then you've got a little flap on top of the flap that protects that joint. And in this case, it's really hiding that joint from aerodynamic, from creating aerodynamic instability. Just to make things a little smoother. But like, I wouldn't be surprised if you could just add a little flap of something just to keep that joint a little less exposed and you'd be okay. It seems like a pretty quickly solvable problem now that they've seen they've gotten to test it and they've gotten to see what happens when their current solution fails. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. The most that I can say is that apparently it's just a huge engineering challenge. I mean, it's been brought up many times and apparently it hasn't been solved yet. So you got the best engineers working on it, but
yeah, I mean, heck, you know, we talk about, the Gemini follow-on program MOL, having a big hole in the heat shield because that's where they were going to have people walk from or float from a Gemini capsule through the heat shield down into a laboratory below it on the stack. And then on the way home, you know, they'd button up that heat shield and separate and they would fly with that port hole first going into the atmosphere. And we talk about that as being a really tough problem is punching holes in your heat shield. I mean, we just talked about Artemis having the holes in his heat shield just for structural purposes being a difficult engineering challenge. So on top of that, we're talking about having a part of your windward side of the vehicle being a fin that needs to flap up and down. Like, no kidding is this a big engineering challenge. And probably one that most anybody who is less risk accepting than SpaceX would have run away from. Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable to say this is a very big engineering challenge.
I don't want to get on my soapbox, but that's one of the biggest things why I think Starship is not going to pan out as advertised is because of this.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I seem to recall that your biggest point of contention was just the sheer number of engines and that, you know.
Well, like the number of engines, like it's the ambition. It's like, it's not just like, rather than go like to the next step, they're like, all right, well, we're going to build something. It's going to be bigger than a Saturn V and it's going to have as many engines or more as like an N1 first stage. And every one of those engines is going to be more complicated than a space shuttle SSME. And we're also going to have to belly flop and do dozens of in-flight refuelings if we want to go, you know, beyond LEO. And like, it's just doing all the things. Like, it's just too much. Like, if you just picked one or two of those to kind of be the next step, but there's so many of them. And then, yeah, but having that many engines and that many complicated engines and just counting on, you know, okay, well, if we lose one or two, we'll be fine. I feel like if you're going to be human rating something, that's going to be something you're going to need to work out. But because imagine having meat bags on board and you're doing this belly flopping stuff. It's just, I don't know.
Oh yeah, it's going to be a lot more testing needed for sure. I mean, it seems like they've got the engine part more or less worked out. I mean, they did lose
it
one.
It is incredible how reliable they are.
So
it's complicated.
But yeah, the fin, that's definitely a problem.
So I was wondering if you guys had a handle on this. So obviously we see the one fin melting away. Was that in like a special, like, I mean, presumably there's another one that's subjected to the same environment on the other side of the spacecraft that didn't have a camera pointed at it. So did multiple fins? Because I see you said that like one of the ones might have had a similar issue.
Yeah, I don't know. That was a question that I was asking myself, and no one's even mentioned that. So I don't know. I would love to know more about that too, because this couldn't have been, I mean, maybe it could have just been some kind of an anomaly where like you know, something in the manufacture. I mean, I don't know what, because it, I mean, it seems like it would be something very noticeable. Like, I don't know. In the forces, the environment should be exactly the same, unless it was reentering at maybe it was rolled slightly, but I don't think so. Maybe.
I don't know why you'd want to. Because
that's the only thing that I can think of. You know, like maybe the mass distribution inside Starship was, you know, not dead center, and so maybe one fin needed to actuate more than the other, and maybe that opened up just as, you know, just enough of a gap, maybe something like that. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. So yeah, in short, I don't know. but yeah, so it kept going. It reached its intended destination, which I think the destination was what, just off the coast of Australia. I didn't see a map of exactly where it touched down, but I believe that that's where it was supposed to be.
Indian Ocean is kind of what I've been hearing.
But yeah, completely successful. And one last thing that I did want to mention is that apparently they left 3 tiles off of the rear skirt. So this is something that basically shields the engines. And that was, you know, intentional, just to kind of test where the weak points are, I guess. I mean, I think that they knew ahead of time that this wasn't going to be a showstopper for the mission. So I'm not sure what kind of data they were looking to get, but like, as I understand it, they do want to test the shielding. Exactly where can you lose a tile and still bring the Starship back? I guess the rear skirt is one such place. The fin, not so much, obviously, because I think it had all its tiles, unless something came off, and maybe that's why. I didn't even think of that. Like, maybe there was some damage, perhaps. I don't know, but I guess it would have had to have come loose, right? Because nothing could have struck it, since it's so high up on the vehicle. But I mean, that's a theory right there, I guess. That's the only one that I have.
So it looks like we were talking about boost back for Super Heavy. Looks like they may be doing that on Test Flight 5. It sounds like it wasn't only accurate enough to land with inside of a buoy, but it sounds like it was accurate enough to land within a virtual tower. Like, they were close enough that they were happy that they could land on the tower.
That's cool.
So they may be doing that next time around.
But yeah, that was the IFT-4 mission. So qualified success, but with a couple of hiccups.
Well, I was going to say, at least, like, yeah, that you have to do, you don't have to do as much qualifying to say that this one was successful versus previous ones. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're really, you know, fighting an uphill battle trying to explain why IFT-3 was still actually pretty good because of, you know, oh, you're learning stuff and the engineering data is great and all that. This one, I mean, yeah, the fact that they both landed, you know, splashed down in one piece, I think is pretty undeniable that you can call this a, you know, a success. But I was wondering, like, are they going to recover these? Couldn't they learn a lot, you know, from literally having the piece of hardware that melted? You got a buoy out there, so you know where it is, at least the booster.
The booster, the first thing they do, their quote-unquote recovery team goes out there and punches holes in the tanks so that it sinks.
Oh.
Which, I mean, which is crazy because there are 33 flight-proven engines. But the thing is just, you know, they've already been soaked in salt water and the thing is just way too heavy to do anything with.
Send some scuba divers to take some pictures of everything up close, though, at least, before you punch the holes
in it. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in the water near it while it's sinking slowly. I mean, maybe that's better than sinking quickly, but like, it's uncontrolled sinking. You don't know what it's going to do.
It is scary looking whenever you see those, when they would recover the SRBs. For some reason, just like seeing an SRB in the water and people like swimming around it, it's very scary looking. Like,
Well, one thing I was going to say. So this flight, more successful than the last, but this one also, they didn't do any, you know, like fuel transfer. And I'm wondering, you know, how much that affected the instability of Starship. And so maybe if they tried to do that again, they might have some issues once again. So maybe, you know, things haven't been solved as much as we might think. Cause I mean, the thought is right. Is it the fuel transfer, right? That might've been what caused the instability.
Tumble, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, center of mass moving around it gets wacky real quick, depending on the vehicle. So
yeah, but I for sure there's still a lot to do. Long ways to go still.
So let's do 3 short and sweets this week. Dennis, what is the first one?
First up, vast plans for ESA. ESA and space station startup VAST have signed a memorandum of understanding outlining their plans for future cooperation. VAST and ESA will study possible ways in which ESA can support VAST through component manufacturing. as well as make use of its future space stations, including Haven 1, which is scheduled for launch in the second half of next year. This memorandum was first obtained by VAST, but it plans to seek out similar agreements with other agencies.
All right, and then next up, Chang'e 6 has its moon rocks. Chang'e 6 has successfully collected its lunar rock and regolith up to 2,000 grams and has launched its ascent vehicle into lunar orbit and docked with its service module. The service module will then make its journey back to Earth in the coming weeks. According to CCTV, the operation has gone smoothly with no issues so far.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
Questions, comments, and correction burns. And this week we have a nice little nitpicky correction. maybe that's the best kind, you might say. Who was it that made this statement that we have a correction for? I don't recall. I don't think it was me.
It was either you. I'm pretty sure it wasn't me either. And my initial thought was that it was Dennis. But then I think, Dennis, you said it wasn't you.
No, it was when you were talking about T. Corbor becoming a Nova.
Yeah. And it was you that said, well, in the past.
Well, yeah, it was in the past.
Yes, okay.
I think maybe, and I don't remember what made the edit or not, but I remember somebody in our chat saying that, you know, technically that it has already happened.
Oh, did it come from, it came from the chat, which is why, Dennis, you were thinking that it was me because I read it.
I thought, yeah, I felt like we collaboratively said the past, you know.
So it's a correction from a listener to a listener. Okay.
Yeah.
we're just mediating.
Yeah, so this comment comes from Trotches, I think is how that's pronounced, on our Discord. And welcome. I haven't seen any, I haven't seen you on our Discord before, so welcome. And Trotches says, I wanted to nitpick from the last episode where we were talking about the periodic nova that you will hopefully be able to see by the end of the year and maybe by the end of next year. And we were joking about how I was saying it's going to happen. And we started joking about how it has already happened. And Chacha says, well, technically, according to relativity, all reference frames are equally valid. From an observer near the star, the nova's already happened, but from our perspective, it hasn't. And so since no reference frame is correct, then they are all correct, and simultaneity is meaningless over large distances. And like, here's the problem. That's true, but so is the concept that it's already happened. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, simultaneity is meaningless over large distances, but we're only here. We're not there as well. So it's okay to say it here. And like, I didn't want to just read this to like roast somebody who commented something that I disagree with. Like, I think that's, it kind of just furthers the absurdity of the fundamental reality of the fundamental structure of our universe is that like relativity is so far divorced from the way that we experience the world and the way that we think about the world that we can say all of these things. And because we mean slightly different things, because we're talking about slightly different parts of the world and slightly different perspectives, it's all true at the same, like it's all fine. It's just what's most helpful in the moment. And in this case, saying that it had already happened as a contrast was funny at the moment. And so that's the perspective that we took. But I mean, fair enough. Like, if you prefer to think about it as not having happened yet because we can't see it, great. That also works. That violates absolutely no laws of physics.
I think it's just that we're, so far as we know, humans are the only beings that can actually know that. I mean, but otherwise, that is correct. It hasn't happened yet, except that we know, you know, or at least that most likely it has because we have brains that, or at least, you know, one guy named Einstein had a brain big enough to, you know, figure this out. So that's why we can say that. All right. So let's move on to This Week in Spaceflight History. We have two correct guesses, Chris S. And then also with the bonus points, Darth Mumu. So congratulations. The clue was a salty Italian. Mm. And Dennis, all right, take it away.
Yes. What is
a salty Italian?
Yeah. So This Week in Spaceflight History is the 11th of June, 2008, and it was the launch of the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. So there's your Italian there, named after Enrico Fermi. But it wasn't so much that he was a salty human being. I mean, I don't know the man, but that salty wasn't part of his personality, or wasn't meant to reflect his personality. So that's where Darth Mumu got the bonus points, because they identified where the salt comes into the clue. But in any event, so this Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope was launched on a Delta II, which I am always amazed when I realize just how long Delta IIs had been flying from 1990 through 2018. So we had talked about a Delta II apparently on the show, which is pretty wild to think about. But yeah, so like a lot of space telescopes, it had a different name before it was, you know, called Fermi. And in particular, it was the GLAST, or Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. And so they typically have a more generic name before they go and get named after, you know, something more, or basically named after a person typically. Yeah. So anyway, GLAST had, you know, was launched in June of 2008 to a circular, you know, LEO orbit, 500-ish kilometers and tilted 25.6 degrees inclination. And so, as the name gives away, it is a gamma ray observatory. And so we've had a bunch of these. They have a very interesting history, I think, where some of the, like we discovered a whole new class of objects called gamma ray bursts. Not to get all astronomy on you, but the lore, and I think this is real history, is that essentially some of these early satellites were put into space and, you know, were able to detect gamma rays, and they were, you know, aimed at Earth during the Cold War to try and see whether or not, you know, if the ones that the U.S. launched were basically looking to see if the Soviet Union was, you know, detonating any nukes, and you could pick up the gamma rays. But they found out that, like, oh, there's actually gamma rays coming from space, like bursts of them. And so that became a whole new kind of field of study and endeavor. And so in any event, the Fermi Space Telescope had has two main instruments. It's still active, which is pretty awesome. And so the workhorse is the Large Area Telescope, or LAT. And basically, it is a 4x4 array of these, you know, blocks, essentially towers, I believe they call them. And a lot of them contain or are made out of sodium iodide. And so that's where the rest of the clue, that's where the salty part, the salty Italian clue comes in, that sodium iodide is part of the detectors. And so the upshot is that, you know, when these, you know, gamma rays come and strike the crystals, you basically are able to go and measure that using a calorimeter, which is, right, a fancy way of just saying you're measuring the energy that's deposited. And so that's how you can tell how much energy that gamma ray had. The Large Area Telescope in particular is sensitive to 20 MeV to 300 GeV energies. Ben, you were very excited a few weeks ago, I think now, where you talked about the anti-coincidence device on a different telescope somewhere, but Fermi has an anti-coincidence shield essentially as well, with the idea being that when you're dealing with very high energies, how do you know that the thing that you're looking at, how do you know that that gamma ray is actually coming from the direction that your telescope is aimed at? Because these can often pass through a lot of solid metals and materials.
And so, gamma rays.
Yeah, they're gamma rays. And so, yeah, that's part of why the anti-coincidence thing is there. Because if you saw something pass through that, then you'd be like, okay, well, that's, you know, it's not legit. That's not what we're looking at. And so, yeah. And so the LAT has a, you know, there's all sorts of technical details, but, you know, this is a $5 word I want to throw at you guys. I don't know if we ever talked about it on the show, but are you familiar with what a steradian is?
Oh.
Steradian.
I don't think so.
Yeah. So basically it has, so the LAT has a greater than 2 steradian field of view.
So like radian, steradian, string radian?
Square radian.
Square radian. Really?
Yep. It's That's taking stupid. The idea of a radian and then, yeah, turning it into an area. And so it's a solid angle on the sky, the kind of natural unit for that straight.
So where does stare, I guess it's just ste, S-T-E.
Yeah, etymology wise, that's an interesting question.
Derived from Greek, steros, meaning solid, and radian,
Ah.
So solid
Steros.
A solid angle is a square angle, you know, angle area. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and then the second instrument is the gamma ray burst monitor. And so this is specifically for those aforementioned gamma ray bursts. It was great that they call this the GBM, and they were able to rename it, which was while still keeping the acronym, which I feel like happens a lot in astronomy, which is pretty fun. It was originally the GLAST burst monitor, but once they renamed GLAST into Fermi, it became the gamma ray burst monitor. And so it's sensitive to much lower energy gamma rays. And in fact, actually stretches down all the way to 8 keV, which is getting into the X-rays. Yeah, so the GBM might be the one that has the actual SALT as opposed to the large area telescope. I know one of them, has these sodium iodide crystals that they use.
So GBM is an initialism, not an acronym, because we don't pronounce it
GBM. Oh, GBM?
No. This is not me criticizing you, because it's perfectly acceptable to call it. So, but
you're channeling the dude from Don't Panic Geocast. Right now.
Well, no, I think it's actually a sternitialism, because clearly it's a solid initialism, because gamma ray, you can change glass to gamma ray and it stays the same.
Nice.
So it's clearly it's solid. So it's a
sternitialism. I like it. Yeah. So the telescope was built by General Dynamics. As I mentioned, it was originally called GLAST, and the renaming was done. It was kind of headed by the then Associate Administrator for Science at NASA, Alan Stern, the man who needs no introduction, right? PI, New Horizons, and also very active in a lot of other things, still. And so he was part of it becoming Fermi. It's still active. It had only a 5-year baseline mission, so 2008, for those of you in the future. Because the future does exist, and this is recording 2024, so we've already gotten, 16 years of Fermi, and so hopefully many more years to come. And so it's history. I mean, it's been, doing a great job, all sorts of science behind it, looking at active galactic nuclei, black holes, gamma ray bursts, like a lot of high energy phenomenon, obviously, given, the nature of the telescope. But a little bit of a rundown of some of the kind of more notable events that happened in its history. In 2012, they had to avoid a collision with Cosmos 1805. And so there was this, a derelict spacecraft, Cosmos 1805. And so, since Fermi was active, they decided to, we're going to stow our antenna, rotate the solar panels away, and fire our thrusters. I think for the first time since they actually went and launched it to go and avoid this collision. According to the wiki entry, at least, they had some line where it was like they were going to be in the same location in space within like milliseconds of each other. Mm. Which is a fancy way of saying they were going to, they were going to hit each other. But that obviously collision was avoided. And Fermi is still kicking. In 2017, I have to assume this was the, I'm going off the cuff here, but I assume this was the biggest discovery or biggest kind of scientific accolade that you can talk about Fermi, is that it observed the gamma rays that came from GW170817, which you might not know that string of letters and numbers, but that was the neutron star merger, gravitational wave merger, which was a real big deal because, we had two, neither object was a black hole. And so we were able to basically figure out all sorts of things when it comes to the creation of elements and things like that from this collision. And what was really cool is that, they were able to trace, the gravitational wave should move at the speed of light and the gamma ray should move at the speed of light. And so they were able to put a constraint on the speed of gravitons, I suppose, by looking at the delay between when Fermi saw this event and then when LIGO and Virgo saw the event. And so very cool.
How far apart were those two observations?
Ooh, a tiny fraction of a second, but let's look that up.
I mean, Wikipedia just says the same day. Just states the day that the observation happened. Let me Oh, here we go. The first electromagnetic signal detected 1.74 plus or minus 0.05 seconds after the merger and lasting for about 2 seconds. Mm. So that's one half. Virgo to LIGO was 22 seconds. 22 milliseconds, 3 milliseconds at LIGO, the second LIGO detector.
I'm seeing 1.7 seconds. Yeah, no, the gamma ray burst was, almost 2 seconds after the gravitational wave. I would have thought it'd be some like, we measured it to like, it was like a billionth of a second. not yeah. Almost two.
I mean, there are plenty of things that can slow light down, dust and shit.
That is true. They just say speed of light in a vacuum is the constant.
And, for however many light years away it was, 2 seconds really is not bad, but... Yeah, it's from a different galaxy, 40 megaparsecs, 130 mega light years.
If you then just consider like the velocity and just you delta V, like delta speed of light over the speed of light, then we're talking about like thousands of a trillionth, a quadrillion accuracy.
Yeah. And so cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
That runs so counter to my expectations. I really thought that it was going to be longer than 2 seconds, not minutes, but I would have thought it would have been a bigger separation, and that's just on gut instinct. I wouldn't have been able to tell you which one I thought got here sooner, but knowing it, looking back, it makes total sense that the light would have been a little slower.
Yeah. So the speed of gravity is within the measurement error, the same speed as the speed of light, which is what we would have expected. So, that's Fermi, a very great history, and continuing to do great science to this very day. And that was this week in spaceflight history.
So I wanted to bring up one other initialism acronym.
Ooh, yes.
LGM.
Little Green Men?
Yeah. But that's not gamma ray bursts, right? That
pulsars? Was a radio signal. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. That was the first pulsar because it was like... Why the hell is a radio signal repeating like that? It must be artificial.
I've got a little bit of radio astronomy on the brain, I guess. I was a little disappointed in the Netflix version of The Three Body Problem when they talked about the wow signal that they did not use. They didn't try to copy the original piece of paper that has wow written on it. It was totally, if I remember right, when I was watching it, I was like, well, that's not what that looked like at all. Like they just had ticker tape or whatever. And I was like, oh man, but we have that document. Like you could have, made a Xerox. All right. Well, thank you, Dennis. I really appreciate the little nugget of astronomy that we get. It's like just the right amount of astronomy. Okay. Next week is the 18th to the 24th of June. David, do you have a clue for us?
I do. Next week's event is in 1982, and the clue is first wolf in space, ?
Good question mark. All right. So if you have a guess as to what the first wolf in space ? Is in reference to. Email us at info@theorbitofmechanics.com or shoot us a toot on Mastodon. Use the hashtag ThisWeekSF. Right now, we only check federated toots on botson.space and spacey.space, but you can always mention at Orbital Podcast at botson.space, and I'll try and follow you and get you federated. Or visit theorbitofmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server. You can type /TWSF to hand your guest directly to Tombot. Good luck, everybody.
Good luck. All right, so let's move on then to upcoming spaceflight events. We have 6 events. We have a NASA TV thing. We got a spacewalk. So it's a mixed bag. So what's the first event, Ben?
All right, first up is a Falcon 9 Block 5 launching Starlink Group 10-2. This was delayed from an earlier launch. I think we mentioned it last week. And now it's it looks like it's going to go off on the 12th. So it's flying out of Cape Canaveral. Slick 40. And we got a big wide window based on marine navigation warnings. So Wednesday, June 12th, between 2108 UTC to the next day at 0136 hours UTC.
And then we have some NASA TV footage coming up on June 12th and 13th. On the 12th, we've got pre-departure remarks from Butch and Sonny at 2:25 p.m. Eastern Time. This is a kind of news conference where maybe we'll figure out when they are actually going to leave the station. That doesn't seem to be clear at this point, at least as of the recording time that we're doing right now. But something that is more concrete is the next day on June 13th, Thursday, at 6:30 a.m. Eastern Time, coverage of U.S. Spacewalk 90 will begin. And so the spacewalk itself is scheduled for 8 a.m. Eastern and will last approximately 6.5 hours.
And we're intentionally waiting to cover Butch and Sonny's ascent. For next week. We're going to wait till we get a little more information.
Next up after that, we have the launch of a Starlink. And this is Starlink Group 9-1, of course, on a Falcon 9 Block 5. And this is from Vandenberg, actually. Vandenberg Space Force Base, Space Launch Complex 4E. And the window for that is 0300 UTC through 0700 UTC. So a 4-hour launch window, I guess.
Launch warning time, right? We're going off.
Maybe that's a better way to put it. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I was like, that's a little bit much. So it's,
At this point, I think we all know what it means. We all understand it. Okay. After that is a Falcon 9 Block 5 launching Starlink. No, I'm just kidding. No, so this is Astra 1P, also known as SES-24. This is a television satellite, like a wide beam satellite television vehicle. It's going to be pointed at Germany, France, and Spain, and it's launching on Monday, June 17th, sometime between 2130 hours UTC and 0130 hours UTC the next day.
And then finally, we have an Electron going to be taking a French mission, No Time to Lose. Or I guess No Time to Lose.
That's a good one.
That is pretty good.
I think the town is called Toulouse, right? Or is it Toulouse?
No, it's called no.
It would be pronounced Toulouse.
Toulouse.
Yeah. So yeah, Toulouse, like the French town. And so yeah, this is a CNES 1 through 5. It's a batch of 5 satellites for the CNES Internet of Things constellation. They ultimately want to have 25 nanosats up in LEO. And so they're using Rocket Lab to get that first batch there, at least. And so while there isn't a specific time of day, this should be launching on Tuesday, June 18th. And so I guess, I do have to say where the Electron's flying from. This will be going from the Mahia Peninsula, New Zealand, and not flying out of Wallops.
All right. Those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
All right. And that means it's time to deal with the show. And we would like to thank Ronald Jenkins and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
We record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Thank you so much to Dennis O, Mike, Haragopal, Astro, Chris S, Kukier, Colin, Calvin Stu, and Stashai Ann for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction burns on the fly.
And if you want to support the show, please leave us a review wherever you listen. Better yet, you can tell a friend. You can also visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign and affiliate links.
Get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about. Or you can skip all that by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
So that's it. We'll see you all next week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye, everybody. See you.